Welcome to the Filibuster, the podcast of Union's Political Science Department. The Senate filibuster is the right to unlimited debate. Then Senator Barack Obama, who participated in about 25 filibusters himself, said one party, be it Republican or Democrat, cannot make all the decisions while the other party is told to sit down and keep quiet. Well, we're not going to tell anybody to sit down and keep quiet today. Instead, we're going to try to have a deliberative and civil debate from our academic, political, and Christian perspectives. I'm Sean Evans. I'm chair of the Political Science Department, and I'm the host of the podcast. Joining me today is Seth Brake, visiting professor of political science, and we have a special guest, David Thomas, professor of history. So we're having this podcast a little bit in honor of President's Day, and so in that regard, we're going to try to have a little fun with this podcast. Now, most everybody agrees that Lincoln, Washington, and FDR are the greatest presidents. There's also a pretty good consensus on who the worst presidents are: Buchanan, Pierce, Andrew Johnson, and William Henry Harrison. You have to feel bad for old Harrison. He is considered one of the worst because of one bad decision. He gave the longest inaugural address on the coldest inaugural day and refused to wear a coat and hat to prove that as an older man he was up to the job. Alas, he caught pneumonia and died 31 days later. I guess I could say something about our two forthcoming presidential candidates, and maybe they could learn something from Harrison about what to wear and how long to speak in that regard, but maybe not much else. So we're going to look at something a little bit different. We're going to look at who are the most underrated and who are the most underappreciated presidents. Now, part of looking at this is we want to try to start thinking through what is it that makes someone a good leader or a good president? Are there things that we see that people have in common? And so with the biggies, yeah, it's a little bit easier to point to. But the fact is, for every Washington, Lincoln, and FDR, we tend to have two, three, four, five, or six more Carters, Hoovers, Buchanans, and others. So let's try to find out what helps us figure out what makes someone a good leader and a good president. So we'll start off with who do you think is the most underappreciated president? And we're starting with our special guest, David Thomas. David.
Well, since you just threw William Henry Harrison under the bus, I have to go with Harrison as our most underappreciated, because in fact he didn't make any major mistakes. He was in office for 1 month and didn't mess anything up. So,
except for his decision to speak for two hours in snowy, sleeting weather.
Isn't that just sacrificing for the common good?
But considering all the other mistakes that presidents with two and three and multiple terms have made, he only made one bad decision, and none of these were politically important.
I'm convinced.
And so he's my vote for the most underappreciated. Underappreciated others, there are a few whose star has fallen, like Andrew Jackson. But for starting, I think I'm going to go with Richard Nixon. I think he was such a strong foreign policy president, a deep influence over the foreign policy of this country, turning back the hard line on Vietnam, entering into dialogue with the Soviet Union and with China. And he's typically remembered only for Watergate.
Right.
And so I think he gets my vote today if we're going to push past William Henry Harrison.
Yeah, I'm going to say I think you've got a good point to make there, and it's not just all his foreign policy stuff. He actually found a way to wind down the Vietnam War in a way that the public found acceptable, a slowly gradual process. And even if we look at his domestic agenda, he realized that he was a Republican when the Democrats had overwhelming control. And so he actually supported a good deal of the Great Society agenda to make sure that they could never accuse him of being too conservative. And that and his ability to go to China kind of changed how people viewed him, to where he could win over 60% of the vote. Of course, he did make one bad decision after that.
One bad decision.
Which was a big one.
That's true. Now he's just tied with William Henry Harrison, though.
Harrison, yes. Okay with that. So, yeah, I think there is a point to make, but that gets to how do we balance one very, very bad decision against all the other good, and that's something we'll talk about as we go. Seth.
Well,
you're
this is
your appreciated one.
See, this is frustrating because I was ready to talk about Nixon. I was going the same way. I found my list was, foreign policy dominated, because that's the stuff I pay most attention to. So Nixon was one of the first to come to mind to me too. But I won't steal your choice there. There's others. I think in terms of overrated or underrated, that whole spectrum. The most interesting thing is the difference, right? So like, I have to say, in terms of underrated, no one is about as poorly rated in the modern imagination right now as Donald Trump, and he was only kind of like he was middling, I think, in most of those things. So I actually think the most underrated president is Donald Trump, not because necessarily of any of his leadership virtues, but I do think that he has a dominance over our imaginations right now in terms of what a president can and can't do. And in terms of foreign policy, he actually was fairly successful. In the beginning, he floundered quite a bit. Like, he flailed, he upset existing alliances, he said things to trouble people. But if you look at the results at the end, the ship was fairly on course. I can't necessarily, people who know my opinions on these things, I'm not a huge Trump supporter necessarily, but I do think that our imagination of Trump is much, much worse than Donald Trump's presidency. So,
yeah, so I will throw this out. When I was mentioning who the consensus worst picks were, mm-hmm. Donald Trump is always in that list. Now, I left him out for the simple reason of we're too close to Donald Trump. And
right.
So I think for us to have a objective view of someone, it takes a while for us to do that. I mean, the reason I would say I would think Donald Trump may fit in mm-hmm. the fail category is because he was so self-destructed. He made everything he wanted to do, even if it was good, more difficult. In fact, I would argue that everything he accomplished was in spite of him instead of because of him.
Maybe.
And so the fact that they had majorities in Congress and Mitch McConnell, mm-hmm. I mean, got those nominees confirmed, it's hard to say whether he actually contributed to that. I will say, though, in time, we'll have to see how his economic nationalism plays.
Yeah.
Because if you look at this, Joe Biden has kept all his tariffs in, which mm-hmm. shows a continuation. And Joe Biden has also adopted an industrial policy when it comes to semiconductors, which flows out of that economic nationalism.
Yeah.
So, I mean, a potential way to where we may find out if he has long-term influence is, does he change how presidents mm-hmm. in the future try to pursue our economic relations?
No, that's a valid point about the difference, but I think that's what makes the question of underrated so thorny and interesting, So I think I'm going to stick with my choice just because I'm focusing on the foreign policy things, but I recognize what you're saying, especially with regard to the domestic policy accomplishments. Yeah. So there's something there.
Yeah. Okay, so it's my turn. Well, people might accuse us of having a partisan bias because everyone who has been mentioned so far and is about to be mentioned are all Republicans, and of the past 70 years. I'm going to throw Eisenhower there. Yeah, so, I mean, Eisenhower was someone who was considered a grandfatherly figure. He sometimes had messed up his syntax, and people weren't sure everything that was going on. But research since then has shown that was a front he was putting up to accomplish what he wanted. And he really had a moderate approach to domestic policy. He stewarded our country in the correct direction in the early days of the civil rights revolution. Mm-hmm. And I think he was rather adept at, in his handling of the emerging Cold War. So in terms of domestic policy, he made the GOP accept the New Deal, no more trying to overturn it. Otherwise, the GOP would have gone into electoral oblivion. He balanced the budget multiple times. He created the interstate highway system. And by pushing through tax credits for health insurance, that made it easier for all companies to provide health insurance to everyone, which kind of created the privatized healthcare system we have, which means if you go to something like Medicare for All, you're taking away health care from about two-thirds of the public, and about 85% are happy with it, which makes that a very tough road to hoe when it comes to civil rights. In Brown, he actually wrote part of the opinion. Now, in Brown, the Supreme Court struck down separate but equal. But in the government's brief in Brown 2 about how to enforce it, it was sent to the White House, and Ike wrote in the phrase "with all deliberate speed," which was the test that the Supreme Court actually chose. And then he used the 101st Airborne to ensure that Little Rock schools were integrated when Orville Forbes said, "No, I won't do it." And he was key in passing the 1957 and 1960 Civil Rights Acts, which were the first Civil Rights Acts since the 1870s. So, I mean, I think that speaks something to that. He ended the Korean War. He kept us out of war with Suez, Vietnam. He created the modern National Security Council. And Sean Trent makes the argument, not one I'm completely sure in, that it's the Eisenhower realignment which made the Republicans the majority with Nixon and Reagan instead of Reagan, in the sense to where he built upon the Yankee Republican businessman in small town non-South with more affluent Southerners in cities and suburbs and had more appeal to white ethnics. So Ike won Southern states, which was unusual for Republicans, won an additional one in 1956 and won a plurality of the vote in 1956. And Nixon also did well following up on that. And he also tried to work to create a Republican Party in his image, which didn't work out. But I think that shows that he had a tremendous amount of influence and stewarded the country in a good direction to set up for the successes of future presidents.
That makes a lot of sense. I mean, I buy the part of your argument that he was a successful president, but you've only proven half of what you have to prove there. I mean, are there people who don't like Ike?
Well, oh, okay. But the thing is, if you look at who are the near greats, it's Jefferson, it's Jackson, it's Teddy, it's Wilson, it's Reagan. You never hear Ike mentioned in those same category. And so for that reason, I think he's underappreciated, because he's really something that should be a model for, I think, many presidents on some level. And I think due to the division that we have today, someone with more moderate sensibilities who can appeal to a lot of people may be what we really need.
Well, now, if you're going to call Teddy Roosevelt underappreciated,
no,
almost great is what you said. Mm-hmm. I think then that puts him into the underappreciated category.
Yeah.
Okay.
I think he's one of the greats. I think he did so much.
Well, I will say he's ranked four in basically about all of them, but most people don't quite put him in the same category as Washington, Lincoln, and
that's fair.
FDR.
Not
as great, but better than the rest. Make the argument, though.
Oh, I'm happy with him at number four. Yeah, I think top five is plenty. he did so much in so many categories to bring progressive era leadership to the fore. He's enormously active in the environment. He's enormously active in business regulation. he's his personality is such that he drags all kinds of people along with him in enthusiasm for reforms of all kinds. He's a giant on the field, the first giant since Lincoln, and I think deserves to be in those in that top five category.
Yeah, and his use of technology to communicate mm-hmm. to the public and to get them on board and to pressure the stalwart Republicans in control of Congress who didn't want that reform was important. And I guess Seth may talk about how he's really the first international president.
Well, that's what I was – yeah, that's kind of what makes him more complicated though, right? I mean, in terms of his successes, a lot of that today we look back on and see imperialism in it, right? So maybe that's what keeps him off the top list sometimes. And also, he did also pioneer splitting the vote against your own party. You know, that's of questionable value maybe. I don't know.
Oh, yeah. It devastated the Republicans for a generation.
Yeah. Yeah.
But that was after his presidency, wasn't it?
Fair enough. Yeah, fair enough.
All right. Let's go with one other real quickly. Who is an underappreciated president? I'll throw in James K. Polk from Columbia, Tennessee. He ran on doing four things and did it. He stabilized the banking system, annexed Oregon and Texas, settled the border between Britain, between the U.S. and Canada, won the Mexican-American War, and annexed most of the Southwest, which truly made the U.S. a continental nation. Now, the downside is his policies rent the Democratic Party apart and made slavery the question of whether it could be extended to the new territories the defining issues for the next 15, 20 years, which was finally settled in a small conflict
well,
that lasted four years and killed more Americans than any other war.
All the other wars combined.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. All combined?
All of them.
Wow.
And the great thing about Polk, too, is that when he had accomplished what he wanted to do, he retired. He went home, which is just a wonderful thing that future presidents could learn from.
I thought a lot about Polk when I was trying to put my list together because I didn't know if he needed to be on the over or under list because it seems like we don't talk enough about how bad he was and we don't talk enough about how successful he was. And for that reason, it canceled it out and he fell off both sides.
Oh, okay. Give us another underappreciated president then.
Eisenhower and Nixon were my next go-tos. And, but you know, okay, I think both Bushes in different ways are underappreciated currently. Mm-hmm. The first Bush, you know, H.W., he was the president during the unipolar moment, right? He presided over the end of the Cold War, mm-hmm. and he showed a remarkable combination of power and restraint in doing that.
Yep.
He was successful at much of what he tried to do in foreign policy during that critical moment, and I think that a lot of our international problems that came from the era following were because his successor didn't follow up on a lot of what he did. So I think we don't consider the first Bush enough in that. But and then when we talk about the other Bush, you know,
I think it's W.
But you're ahead. Absolutely W. correct. Yeah. Yes, His character, as revealed from the people who knew him, the people who talked about him, was inspiring in some ways that didn't necessarily translate into his policy concerns. And so I actually, when I was drawing up my list, I really struggled because I worked out a character-based list, then I worked out an accomplishments-based list, and I struggled between them. And the first Bush ended up on one list and the second on the other. I'll do a two-for-one on that one and keep the family together.
Yeah, so here, I'll also say something positive about the elder Bush. So you mentioned foreign policy. He also negotiated the START Treaty, which was the first mm-hmm. reduction of nuclear weapon arsenals. That's impressive. He went against his party to raise taxes and to restrain spending to try to reduce the deficit. That's not something we'll see people go against their base. He passed the Clean Air Amendments in 1990, which shifted environmental policy from a command and control system to a more free market system, which had tremendous success in quicker time than expected, and which is the basis for all environmental treaties today. It's gone national. So, I mean, I think he probably is underappreciated too.
He sometimes H.W. reminds me a little bit of Taft. In that he's living in the shadow of somebody who garnered enormous acclaim, and for all of his accomplishments, he's never going to garner that acclaim himself. Taft, I think, was a good solid president in this underappreciated category, but he's between Roosevelt and Wilson, so he's the guy who got stuck in the bathtub.
Yeah, well, but with that. Teddy was concerned he wasn't progressive enough, but he busted more trust and regulated business in ways that that Teddy never did.
And he set aside more land, he protected more land than Roosevelt did as well.
Yeah, wow, okay. All right, so we've gone through the underappreciated. Let's go to the overrated, which may be a little bit more difficult to do. Seth, we'll start with you.
Well, I'm gonna break the rule again. I think the most overrated president from people I talk to is Donald Trump. I think he fits on both lists because his detractors are more afraid of him than he warrants, and his supporters I think give him more credit than he deserves. But we've already discussed why maybe our view of Trump is still not clear. So I'll I think maybe Madison is remembered more for his political theory than his policy accomplishments, because as president, you know, started a war he couldn't win, you know, that went fairly poorly. So I think I'll put Madison on there just because of the difference between all the things we remember him for in a positive sense. None of them came from his presidency.
Yeah, okay. I'm going to throw JFK there. Someone that had ambition, charisma. He was inspirational, but his accomplishments were meager. I mean, he started the Bay of Pigs, which is a fiasco. The good thing is he learned from it, and then he had a cool hand during the Cuban Missile Crisis, which he should get credit for. But when it comes to legislative accomplishments, there just wasn't that much that he did. I mean, yes, he was pro-civil rights, but he never could pass one. He never really tried to pass one. He never really made a push until some of the protests and the response were so bad. He made a nationally televised address, but he wasn't really doing what he needed to pass it. And the question is, would he have the skills like LBJ did to actually get something like that done? And I don't think we really saw that from him. So I think he's an overrated president.
Yeah, I'm with you on that. For overrated, I'm going to go with Jefferson. I think he had one great accomplishment as president. That was Louisiana Purchase, and his responsibility in that was he's batting cleanup. John Adams made it possible by avoiding extended confrontation with France, and so Jefferson took that and ran with it. And to his credit, it turned out very, very well. I'm not sure the other good things that he might have done. His ending with the embargo was just a disaster. Jefferson seems as a politician to be one of these brilliant lights that shines now and then retires to his plantation. The Declaration of Independence is one of those examples. His governorship of Virginia, I think, was maybe his most extended period of productivity. But as president, he was thoroughly average, I think.
Well, and he's on my list too. And part of what I would also say with that is he ran against the Federalist policy, but he institutionalized most of the Federalist policy. And you can even say he violated his constitutional principles to adopt Federalist principles to actually do the Louisiana Purchase. And so he ran one way, he governed another way. Not that that's necessarily a bad thing, but then I think that does kind of call into question a little bit about his principles and what he's willing to do to get and keep power.
Oh, I think it's entirely consistent with his character, yes. And eventually we can go down that road, but Jefferson's character is consistent in the 1790s and in the early 1800s. He switches sides with ease.
Okay, in Any other you want to throw out a quick overrated?
Well, I think some of the mythologized presidents don't quite live up to the myth. Like we mentioned FDR earlier. He was a great man who accomplished great things, right? But at the same time, if we look back on his on the role that he played in U.S. history, he was personalizing power. He was in that era of, you know, these strongman leaders popping up all over the world, and I think we saw the American democracy version of that in a way that could have been a lot worse than it was. You know, and maybe in some ways we are fortunate that he had the health problems he did and maybe couldn't become what he might have become, you know. So maybe it's not fair to judge someone on potential, but the way that he was reforming and expanding the government and personalizing power and serving multiple terms, you know, I think that maybe we give him a little too much respect, even though, you know, he was one of the great presidents.
As long as we're in the mythologizing category, I'd want to go to Reagan as well. The mythology is so powerful. At least it was for 20 years, and yet as president, he was very, very fortunate. Food prices and energy prices dropped during his presidency, and that enormously helped the economic upturn that it was experienced, 18-24 months in. And he was great with Gorbachev, no doubt about that, and set up HW's what you call it, a unipolar moment. I love that term. I'm going to remember that. But still, I think the mythology is greater than the reality in this case.
Okay, I'm going to have to people tend to think very highly of, I'm going to throw Harry Truman on that list. I mean, yes, he did set the legislative agenda for Democrats in terms of health care, civil rights, and a lot of other things for 50 years, but he wasn't able to accomplish it. It's not just what you want to do, it's what you can do. He's considered appointing some of the worst cabinet and Supreme Court members because he appointed too many of his cronies who weren't necessarily competent. And they sometimes were even a little corrupt. And for the big things he does get credit for in terms of the post-Cold War foreign policy, that was also the consensus post-World War II, and so he was just ratifying that more than leading that. And so I'm not quite sure that he is all that he is made out to be. All right, so let's go back to how we started this off. What is it that makes for good or great leaders? I'll say good or great because few people have the opportunities to be great, but all of them have opportunities on some level to be good. So based on what we've said or things you've been thinking about, what are some of the characteristics of good or great presidents?
Well, I'd probably start with vision, an ability to understand not only the timeline of the immediate, but also the ability to look at the distant horizon. The horizon that these folks work with is enormous. And to be able to imagine that, to see that, you know, Theodore Roosevelt sets the environmental agenda for the first half of the 20th century. And that's just a remarkable vision. So I suppose I would start there. Can they see not only the immediate, but the potential for long-term good, which they might do as leaders?
I think that's a really good point, because when I was forming my list, I kept thinking about Jimmy Carter because of how much I kind of sympathize with him when I read about, you know, the things he did, the decisions he makes. He made mistakes that I felt like I might have made. Right. And when I, you know, think about that, I think vision is part of what's missing there and why he has a bad reputation. He probably deserves it. Right. So I couldn't put him on either list because of that. But I think I buy the vision thing. I think the other element you need, though, is you have to have the vision for where to go and then the ability to read the room to get there. You have to have the effectiveness there. I think the practical and the ideal need to combine for greatness.
Yeah, so I'm going to build upon that. I think a good president has to have a strategic sense of knowing what they can accomplish under the circumstances.
Right.
circumstances. So Bill Clinton said, I want to be the president who provides universal health care. And he made this big plan and said, if you don't give me that, I'll use this pen, I'll veto it, and I'll send it right back to you. But the Reagan idea that we don't trust the government was so high to where a government-run healthcare system was something that backfired against him. And so he wasn't able not just to read the room, but to read where the people were and what was possible at that time.
Yeah, let me revisit the Carter thing. I wonder if Carter was laboring under conflicting visions, right? He's such a strong Christian man. And he's in an office which consolidates power, and the consolidation of power is often directly at odds with the gospel of love. And so I wonder if part of Carter's problem is that he had a big vision, but it was a vision of the church, of the gospel, of and that I think made it perhaps more difficult for him to extend the power that a president can and probably should extend.
Yeah, I think some of the things I've read was he would make his proposals, make the argument, and just expected people to agree with him. He didn't quite know how to do the bargaining and other stuff that presidents need to be able to do to pass bills.
Work with Congress.
I think that is a fair read on him. I want to push back a little bit on the idea that that power acquisition itself is something that maybe Christians are uniquely bad at, because I do think that there are principles of prudence to be found in our faith that that can handle power in a way that is effective. And I think maybe this is part of why I keep empathizing and sympathizing with Carter is because, you know, I see in myself some of those deficiencies sometimes. But I don't think they're deficiencies that come from my faith. I think they're deficiencies that come from my lack of sanctification on some issues, because maybe I fear the outcomes of those power of power because of a lack of faith or something like that. You know, I think maybe I don't want to frame Carter's error as necessarily good theology, but maybe bad theology that I just can't quite complete yet.
Yeah, I was making less of a theological argument and more of an argument that perhaps they conflicted within Carter himself.
That makes sense.
Okay, so we're kind of on this track, so let's continue it. What role does moral authority and moral leadership play in being a good or a great leader?
Well, it certainly has a great place in leadership. Moral authority takes all kinds of forms, right? One of them is the ability to recognize other people's strengths and utilize them. One of them is a basic humility regarding your own place in history, your own place in the world, your own place in your community. And these obviously are indispensable. You can't operate as a successful leader in a republic without managing these moral virtues, without holding them.
That's a very good point there. I think the other aspect that is emerging as I think about these different presidents and evaluate them is also a strong sense of justice, I think. There's a certain timidity that comes from being having a conflicted or unconfident view of justice. Sometimes, you know, it's hard to tell from the outside whether someone is puffed up with pride or has a solid sense of right and wrong. And unfortunately, that's something, you know, that there's a subjectivity to being able to observe that, something only God can judge in some ways. But the effective leaders do have it. And I think that's the other side of that.
Yeah, I think this whole idea of pride, I mean, the way I look at this is, to run for president, to be president, you have to have enough confidence that you can do that job, which is, you have to have tremendous confidence, but not so arrogant that you think only you can do the job.
Or that you can do it yourself.
Yes. And I think that's kind of that balance you have to find. You don't want to shrink inviolate behind the resolute desk. but yet you also don't want someone who thinks everything's about him. And I think that's part of this key aspect of moral leadership is, are you thinking about the other people and potentially even the least of these? I struggle with how you rate someone like Andrew Jackson. I mean, I look at someone, he created the mass-based party system, modern campaigning. He was first president who really tried to be a policy leader. He was a nationalist. The president's job is to defend the nation as a whole. He created executive responsibility and the idea that the cabinet is responsive to him. Things which you look and say, okay, these are pretty important things in developing presidential power and his place in the system. But then you also have to counter it with the pettiness of how he treated people, the scurrilous attacks he made against his opponents, and then the treatment of Native Americans. He didn't see them as people. Otherwise, he could not have done what he did. So how it's part about how do you balance good things, I think you said, accomplishments versus moral authority, moral leadership, because I think we are that pursuing justice. Because even in terms of pursuing justice, he also was the one who pushed and accomplished universal white male suffrage. So, I mean, wasn't everybody, but at least all white males at that time could.
Yeah, and with some issues like slavery, race, Native Americans, votes for women, I think the moral issues get a little bit trickier because we tend to judge them by our own standards. And I think it's so important to keep in mind the standards of the day. Jackson did terrible things to the Cherokees, yes, and overrode the Supreme Court and overrode the state of Georgia and the rest of it, but he had the support of the vast majority of Americans. And so for those Americans, for most of those Americans, is this a problem of a bad morality on the part of Jackson? Probably not. At least not when it came to political things. So they've got some difficult edges to them. And I think when judging previous presidents for their morality, it's probably worth asking, how would they judge us? What would Jackson say about our culture? And he would certainly, you know, knowing Jackson, he would have some really pointed things to say. And he would definitely say them directly to your face.
Yeah, I think judging by the standards of the day is a powerful tool for understanding people's actions. But I also think we need to be able to say this thing that happened was wrong. I mean, people at the time knew these things were wrong. They might have been in the minority, but we have their voices. We have what they said. You know, I think there's also a danger of over contextualizing to the point where we want to turn all morality into a subjective judgment when I don't think it is fundamentally. Like, I feel comfortable saying that Andrew Jackson did something wrong, even if I say, and I understand why he did it, you know, because, and to your last point, I think that's exactly why, because we need to be able to externalize our own perspective and say, you know, what might they say about us and what might people in the future say about us as well, but it's because of that universal standard that we ought to be able to apply backwards and forward. So, you know, I think I agree with you that that's the best tool for analyzing it, but at the same time, I don't want to say that means that I can't sit in judgment of them, because I can.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it's valid too. Mm-hmm.
I think when we look at this, we have, I mean, it just raises the importance of character in the people who we lead. And I think the higher up, the higher level of office, the more important that character is. Because in a democracy, we are electing people who are going to represent us, and the idea they say they're going to represent us. So the idea is, are they going to represent what we want, or are they going to do what they want to do? And it's also, when you have great power, I guess I'm going to quote Spider-Man here, with great power comes great responsibility. Are they going to abuse that power? And right. I think maybe something we have to look at is, if for someone like Jackson, he did represent the people of time, but by ignoring the Supreme Court and others, was that an abuse of power that potentially went too far? And so are these the kinds of things that in a democratic system we need to consider?
I think the way you put that, you just put a piece into place for me into thinking about this.
Oh, well, good.
Because, you know, when we want to judge these leaders, I think we too often view the opposite of doing the wrong thing as doing nothing, when there's also doing the right thing, and sometimes doing the wrong thing is doing nothing. And we can only make decisions on what happened, right? Not what didn't happen. But, you know, it's kind of like in political psychology, the idea of risk-averse actors, right? Mm-hmm. Who you know, treat a loss. I think sometimes we're risk-averse in morality. And I think that is that vision we're talking about as well, is the understanding that sometimes you have to act. And I think as Christians, that's also where we need to be able to act in faith of God's goodness and justice in these things, where we need to be able to pursue justice vigorously. I think some of these leaders who we view as failures might also have been too timid in the pursuit of what is right. And I think that's the missing piece, at least for me in thinking about this, the missing piece in my framework for this judgment was in overrating wrong action versus inaction.
Yeah, and then of course, okay, so Jackson represents, or whoever it is, represents the American people, but the American people are by no means of one mind.
Right.
And so he can only make one decision, and yet there are these multiple perspectives, each with their own morality attached to them. To grapple with the morality of the problem then asks, okay, so if he did something different with the Indians, how would that change? Then we're into the world of speculation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
but the American people are almost never of one mind.
Yeah,
and so to represent them well is quite the challenge.
All right. Well, we're running out of time here, so I'm going to kind of sum up a bit from something I read by Henry Kissinger. He's written a book on leadership. He looks at six people who he interacted with in trying to figure out what makes someone a good leader, looking at people who led in different ways. And he made a distinction between statesmen and prophets. Statesmen embrace change but retain the essence of their societies and advance them through an evolutionary process. Prophetic leaders seek immediate historic transformation. They imagine a new future and seek to transcend the past. In reality, what most leaders need to do is combine the two, infuse these two ideas of statesmanship and prophecy or propheticness together in the right proportion and at the right time in which they are living and leading. So that's one way to look at it, which combines vision, the ability to get stuff done. And with that, I think our time is up. Thank you, David, for participating. Thank you, Seth. And I yield back the balance of my time.